welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director Jean-Pierre Jeunet and his 1991 film Delicatessen. Returning on the show today to discuss Delicatessen is Professor Marie Wester. Professor Westhaven, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So this is definitely one of the most interesting post-apocalyptic movies I've seen. When you think of post-apocalyptic movies, I mean, it's definitely a genre. I mean, the first thing that obviously is going to come to mind, at least for me, is the Mad Max movies. And this is definitely not a Mad Max movie. What's interesting about this movie is I'm not even sure. Like, I always think of apocalypse, you think no society. There's absolutely nothing left. It's basically dog eat dog, every man for himself. Like, this hasn't gotten to that point yet. There still seems some structure of society, and that's what's really interesting about this to me.
Yeah, it's post-apocalyptic, but they haven't used up all of the resources yet, so it's a matter of how long before it really is all gone. But it reminds me more of Soylent Green.
Definitely Soylent Green. I was thinking about that.
You know, it's this time set in the future, and nobody's talking about what you're really eating. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, of course, is the big reveal.
You know, it's people.
Soylent Green is people.
Yeah, because it's always so interesting is because not only do you have this, you know, this house, which once again has the structure of a landlord, you know, you have mechanics of people taking care of the place, you know, you have electricity. There's even some sort of TV station running around because they have, like, programming and everything. So once again, like, that's not all the way apocalyptic. And I think the one woman said that they're in the year of Virgo, which they believe that would make it like the year 12,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to set it way in the future, mm-hmm. so you can do whatever you want, because you saw what happened to the book 1984.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which it's because this is set like supposedly in the very far future, but everything looks pretty like almost retro. Like,
yeah,
you got the old TVs that look like from the 1950s. There's nobody's dressed like an outlandish, you know, futuristic uniforms. Everybody's dressed like almost, it looks like something for, like a world from like the 40s or the 50s.
Yeah. You're expecting the Jetsons, though.
Yeah. And then once again, no technology. It's all pretty, not almost modern, but like past. It's, mm-hmm. There's nothing really futuristic. Like I said, old TVs. There's like a ham radio. There's no like flying cars or using bicycles. I don't even think there is a car in the movie. I don't think there was one car in the movie.
I think that's part of the apocalypse. There's probably no gasoline.
No gasoline, which is again Mad Max.
Mad Max.
And it's interesting because this film is really a mixture of a bunch of different things. Like you said, it could be sci-fi because it's set in the apocalypse, but it's like I said, post-apocalyptic. But there's also a lot of horror elements. And it's also very black comedy. So it is like this very interesting mix mash of all these different genres.
The black comedy is the part I think is the most charming. It's like Amelie in that it's got all these odd colors that give it this wonderful atmosphere. But it's mm-hmm. off kilter. It's a weird fairy tale. But I like the point you make about it being a horror movie, since you're an expert. What did you think about the atmosphere in terms of creating that mood?
I think you definitely see that, the horror elements in that opening scene when I believe it's one of the guys from underground, the troglodytes.
Yes.
Yeah, he goes up there and then the butcher guy is hunting him down and then he kills him. Like, it's, you could, that scene is played out in like nearly every slasher movie ever made. Somebody's hunted down with a meat cleaver. And at the end, you hunt him down, you kill him, and then boom, you serve him up to your guests, your tenants.
Yes. But don't tell them. You know, that's mm-hmm. very important that they don't know this.
So that's the one part of the film I was a bit confused. So they don't know that that they're being served people?
Well, I think that the people eating the people know that they're eating people. The people who become the food don't know that until it's too late.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, you'd notice in the beginning of the movie, there's a guy who's trying to escape because he's figured it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. So.
And also, once the former clown shows up, you know, everybody's thinking, oh, he's going to be next, right? You know, but once they start to get to know him and they even start to admire him a little bit, he's got a little bit of celebrity cachet, they don't want him then to turn into food. It's like the old story about, you know, you don't name your chickens or whatever because you don't want to become emotionally invested in something that you know is ending up on the table.
So all the tenants know that they're being served people?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And they know that he's like kind of luring people in with like these ads.
Yes.
So they can be meat. Okay, I was a bit unsure about that. Okay. And like you said, like, because as far as the director, once again, I knew that this was the same guy that directed Amelie. Amelie was this huge international success. And I can, it just feels, definitely feels like it's the same guy that directed Amelie. You got, like you said, the weird camera angles, wide angle shots. You know, the you said the color palette, the scheme, the very mix of dark humor. I mean, like, yeah, like you said, this is very much the same guy that directed Amelie.
Yeah, and the sort of toying with the fringe elements of society, because Amelie is this love story. But then when you really look at it, it's like, but she falls in love with a guy who works at like a dirty bookstore or something. Yeah. I mean, that's really sort of odd for a main character. But that's him just, you know, knocking you off your pins, you know, taking what you expect and make it unexpected.
Yeah. And it's like, not only that, but like, I remember watching this, it does feel a lot like a, people, I think, sometimes compare him to like the French Tim Burton. I think he's more.
Yes, there is a Tim Burton element there, I think.
I think he's more of like the French Terry Gilliam.
Okay.
This does feel like a film Terry Gilliam would make. It's like you said, like the mix of dark comedy and this futuristic society. Like Brazil is one of the things that I thought about, and just, you know, kind of the way, like, you know, like you said, you got the troglodyte people, and like this, like those are, feels like somebody out of a Terry Gilliam film, because Terry Gilliam once again was a member of Monty Python, so he kind of had always this bit of dark humor. He could mix all these kind of strange creatures and people in it with something like Baron Munchausen or Brazil. So it feels, even though, like you said, I can see where definitely see where people think he's like the French Tim Burton, I would say he's more like the French Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, that's a good, that's very that's a good observation, because, you know, Terry Gilliam has a lot of wit and intellect in his setups, where Tim Burton is cartoonish in a way. He appeals to children as much as adults, because Coraline, I mean, some of the things that he's done have been children's stories.
Yes.
Even though they're pretty creepy, you know, for children's stories.
Yeah, and then Tim Burton's always been more, like you say, I always say he's like the goth thing. Like, and you go to a Hot Topic, you'll find like,
yes,
how many shirts
Jack
of
Skellington,
like, Jack Skellington and Edward Scissorhands and whatever, Johnny Depp's in. So he's very kind of appeals to that gothic culture. But I don't think this movie is like very appealing to goths, at least in I don't think.
No, because it doesn't really have an obsession with darkness. But it is dark.
Definitely.
Now, the interesting thing about the story itself is that the director got the idea because he used to live in an apartment above a butcher shop. And each morning at 7 a.m., he would hear, you know, the clash of knives and the guy saying, chop, chop. So his girlfriend would say that they were carving up the neighbors and they would be next. And then in 1988, he visited America and said the food was so bad, it tasted like it was actually made out of humans.
Yeah, and so this was actually his first directorial debut, his first film.
But this wasn't the movie he wanted to do first. He wanted to do a movie after the success of this, they let him do, which was The City of Lost Children. Which, you know, they gave him sort of carte blanche. That was such an expensive movie to make. But they decided to do this one instead with no money. They used, they had friends and family appearing in the cast, and most of the props were just things that they scavenged, which I think kind of helps it give it that apocalyptic look.
Yeah, because it does feel like we talk about how it's a bit of 40s, bit of 50s culture, and it's like it doesn't really have this uniform feel to it, because it, like you said, it feels like just everybody was just grabbing what they could get because of the apocalypse, and there's no stores or anything.
See, this is what I liked about what you said in a previous episode about horror films, that it's what people do to each other that's far worse and more horrifying than any monster that you could invent. And you know what they're up to in this, it's talk about a niche society. But then you have to imagine what hunger does to you. And I actually looked up some other films to see how popular a topic this was. There's a lot of movies with this in it.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things you talk about, you know, post-apocalyptic society resorts to cannibalism is a Snowpiercer, and how they find out that they're actually being served people. And there's this monologue from Chris Evans who says, like, I know what baby tastes like. Yeah. I mean, the way he delivers it, I can't help but laugh because it just sounds so silly. But it's like a very haunting scene. He goes, because I know what baby tastes like.
See, they even said, like, back in the early days in this country, that people starved through one winter, and they actually dug up the bodies that had been buried and ate them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you never know what you're really capable of. And then I think about that book and movie Alive, where they crash in the mountains.
Oh, about the rugby team?
I don't know if it was a rugby team. This was quite a long time ago.
Yeah, the story about the rugby team that crashes in an airplane, they resort to cannibalism.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't remember they were rugby players. I just remember reading it and thinking, eventually, you know, you get desperate enough, you'll do all kinds of things you wouldn't think you would do.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of cannibalism and all this, every time we talk gleefully. Yeah, but every time I think about that, we talk about cannibalism, I just think about that Monty Python sketch where they're like, there's stranded on a boat, and he was like, "We're out of food." He goes, I want you guys to eat me. And he goes, why would I want to eat you? You got a gammy leg. And so they keep bickering about, well, he's healthy. How about you eat him? And then like a waitress comes by. I was like, all right, we'll have a leg of him. And then the arm, it just cracks me up every time.
That's fair. See, there's Terry Gilliam.
Terry Gilliam, once again, bringing it back. And like you said, what's interesting, I talk about how this is a debut film. He actually started out directing short animated films in the 80s. And I can kind of see, like we go going back even to the Tim Burton thing, I can see how that sort of plays out in this movie. Like, you could see it somehow played out like a stop-motion animated, something like A Nightmare Before Christmas or a Coraline.
Yeah, definitely. And the short films that they mentioned I have not seen. But now, of course, I want to look them up. His partner, Caro, is the guy.
Caro,
yes. He's the guy who does all the artistic stuff. Juné is the guy who worked with all the actors to get the performances that he wanted. And by the way, I think he does a great job with that. I think mm-hmm. every actor in the movie is important and does a good job without going over the top, because it is sort of over the top.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that you talk about Mark Caro. It's like we've been talking about Jean-Pierre Jeunet, but this film, Mark Caro is credited as co-director on this movie, and I believe he was also credited as co-director on City of Lost Children.
Yes.
So I'm more familiar with Jeunet work, but is Caro, after they've had that collaboration, has he gone and done anything?
I think he's done things with Jeunet.
But after Jeunet, nothing?
I don't think so. I think they're a matched set. And by the way, I wanted to mention that in the beginning, if you're watching the movie for the first time, check out the credits, because the crew members' names appear on objects that the camera tracks across.
Yeah, so it was a very good opening title
yeah,
sequence.
Yeah, the director of photography is on a camera, and the composer's name on a broken 12-inch record, etc. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, and like even like the editor, they have it on like this sequence of reels, and it's like, oh, that's really clever.
Yeah, it's very clever, because it gives you some context.
It's like, once again, when you think of opening credits, like, they, you know, you just think of the scene playing out and then just have bottom text, you know, directed by this, produced by this. Nothing really important, because they just want to get it out of the way so the story can go on. But I like how they played into it a little bit, bringing up the setting, because it's set in this butcher shop. And I really enjoyed that opening title credits.
Yeah, it was Saul Bass-esque.
Very good point, Saul Bass.
He would have been all over this. The closing credits also show images of every actor from the movie.
And you were talking about how every actor and actress really feels the part, and they definitely do. The main person in this movie is Dominique Pinon.
Yes.
Who was, what was his character's name? Jonathan?
I can't remember.
Okay, well, the clown guy. We'll
the clown guy, yes.
And like, that's like a face you don't forget.
He has
a
very
identifiable face. One of the things I knew him was, he was an Amelie, right?
Yes.
He was like the possessive boyfriend.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was also in, did we ever talk about Roman de Guerre?
No, we did not.
Okay. That's a great movie with him in it.
Okay. Well, once again, like you say, everyone's got that, like even the butcher, he's got like this piggish, you know, swine, you know, ugly looking face. Like, everybody's got, like, this unique face that you're not going to forget.
Yeah, Juné likes working with actors with really different-looking faces. Even Audrey Tautou, who's got real big eyes. You know, she's very arresting-looking, too. He likes characters or actors with unusual facial features. He also, his main characters are almost always orphans or have lost one of their parents. That's a favorite theme of his as well. And often focus on a romance between two mavericks. Louison, that's the name of
Louison.
Louison and Julie are an example there, or Amelie and Nino.
Yeah, you say he always like has these regular people, and they all have like this particular quirk. Like another one of the characters I liked was the wife who's like obsessed with suicide, and so like I love that part where she's creating this really elaborate getup to set up where, you know, opens the door, gunshot. She's going to hang herself, then she's going to take pills, and she's going to open the oven, and then, like, another thing. And then she thinks, like, all at least one of these will work. And then, like, that one scene goes, somebody screws something up, everything fails miserably.
Yeah, it's like a Rube Goldberg.
Yeah, and, like, it's dark, but it's still pretty damn funny.
And it is funny, yeah. And because she keeps trying. Each time you're thinking, come on, maybe this time it'll work. You think, wait a minute. That's not what you're supposed to think.
I don't want her to do that, no. And then at the very end, it's just a random accident that she wasn't planning to happen that finally does her in with the explosion. And it, what's interesting, because when I think about Jeanette, and I think mainly this movie and Amelie, like, I think one of the things, like, especially in looking up online, everybody says, oh, this is such a French film. And why is it that his style is commonly associated with his country's film overall? I mean, I guess maybe more modern, but when I think of, like, just like going stereo, we're just getting into stereotyping here because you can't really boil down an entire country's film into like one style. But if I'm being like completely stereotyping, I think more of like the French New Wave, particularly mm-hmm. Godard, you know, guy with a beret, sunglasses, smoking a cigarette with all these jump cuts and like, oh, you ignorant Americans. This is how you make cinema. You're the cinephiles. You know.
Yes, you are really on to something there. Yeah, it's the idea of film as art. You know, they say the first cinema is, you know, Hollywood blockbusters, and everybody knows what they are, and they're exported everywhere. But then the second round was people using cinema for art, and the French were big on that with the jump cuts that you mentioned, mm-hmm. the French New Wave, and the breaking the fourth wall, you know, like Amelie does. Or you go all the way through the movie of Amelie with this narrator who's never explained. I mean, who is this, the voice of God? He tells you things mm-hmm. about the characters. It's interesting, but it's odd because it's new.
Yeah, which even going, that's also something like out of Godard. Like there were narrations in like Band of Outsiders, mm-hmm. a lot of his other films, because you know, once again, they're not connected with the story at all. Like, who are these people?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of the time, the Hollywood style is meant to make you not notice that you're watching a movie. You're supposed to just sort of, the lights come up at the end of the movie and you blink and you're like, oh, okay, I was completely lost in that movie. Where the French want you to notice all this cool stuff that they're doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the stereotype.
Oh, okay.
So since it is so different, you know, you're looking at all these things and you're thinking, wow, how did they do that? And that must have been an amazing mm-hmm. crane shot. And, you know, all the cool things that they're doing are really out there, you know, for you to see. You're not sitting there thinking, where did 2 hours go? You're noticing all of the details.
Okay. Everybody's saying, oh, it's such a French film. I'm like, what, just because there's an accordion soundtrack?
Because it is so French.
It is so French.
It is so French.
You know, we make real cinema, not like you and Americans.
That's right. Yeah.
And one of the things that you won't touch on earlier is how he thought the food tasted terrible in America. Mm-hmm. He thought it was might as well made by people. He thought the butcher in the house he lived at was like, you know, carving up the neighbors. And I wonder... It reminded me a little bit, bear with me here, of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original one from 1974, because I know, looking at some interviews by Guillermo del Toro, who was a big fan of that movie, was an influence on him, he said that movie turned me into a vegetarian.
Okay.
Because that movie has like this, there was this, you know, the people who were doing these killings in that movie, they were like laid off, they were part of like a slaughterhouse, and like, they describe like what they do in the slaughterhouse. One guy even demonstrates on himself in that movie. You would love it.
No, I probably wouldn't.
But even like when Leatherface, the main guy, like kills his victims in that movie, he hangs them up and he kills them like they're cattle. Like he uses like this hammer thing like they would use at a slaughterhouse when he hangs people on a hook, just like you would hang up in the meat at the slaughterhouse. And like they're even carving up people and serving them in the you know, like a slow cooker thing, mm-hmm. and like one of the people's being even served it. And like some people have even said, like, this is a vegetarian movie because you're being seeing this horrible things, what they're doing to people who are being used as meat. Like they're like that movie is saying that it's almost a commentary on what's going on in slaughterhouses. And it's like, do you really want to, knowing what went through to get that on your plate, do you really want to eat that? And I wonder if this was meant to be a vegan film, because even though it's not really saying anything about meat, but like once again, look what happened just so you can get that on your plate.
You know, and that's an interesting thing to bring up, because one of the characters, and I thought this was hilarious, continually floods his apartment. and has, you know, frogs and snails, and there's like a whole pile of used, you know, shells, which makes you wonder, is he a vegetarian?
Was he eating them?
Seafood. Well, yeah. I think he's eating the frogs because and the snails and everything, because that's why there was a pile of used shells. You know,
I thought those were just like snails that were crawling on the wall. I don't know. I thought he was keeping them as his pets because I remember the two kids, like they get the net and they were trying to get one of the frogs and he just screams at them and then they run away. So I'm thinking like he's keeping them. He doesn't want them to be eaten because not once did I see him, like, I don't know, having a plate or eating any of the snails. I mean, once again, going into French stereotypes, like, oh, yeah, they eat frogs and they eat
and
snails.
And they eat snails,
yeah,
right.
Escargot.
That's what's wrong with that. Yeah. But raw. No, I definitely had the impression that he was eating them. But my question would be, is that because he doesn't want to eat people? Or is that because he's, you know, is it a moral thing? Or is it a vegetarian thing? Although eating snails is not vegetarian. Yeah.
I don't know, because I just assumed he was keeping them as pets. But, well, I'll have to do some, maybe have to do more diving to see if he was keeping his pets or he was eating them. But, you know, once again, French, so maybe they're eating frogs.
You know, some could be pets and some could be food. You know, if the frogs you name you don't eat, the other ones you do.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it did remind me of some other movies, like Fried Green Tomatoes. There's a terrible character in there that you love to hate for most of the movie, and when they finally get the revenge on him, he ends up in the barbecue. And it also reminded me of a Danish movie which we should definitely discuss, called The Green Butchers.
Okay.
And it has Mads Mikkelsen and Nikolaj Lie Kaas in it, who play brothers who run a butcher shop. It's not doing well. One day there's an unfortunate accident. And then everybody comes in because the steaks there are, you know, reputed to be so incredibly delicious.
He was in Brothers. Which one was he?
He was the brother who...
The one that went to war or the other guy?
The other guy.
Okay, and that was also the guy that was in...
The Black Sheep.
Yeah, he was China the Dogs.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Now I know who you're talking about. And what's interesting about Jean-Pierre Jeunet, I mean, this film, I mean, he kind of had a few hits in a row. I mean, he had this film... Then he said City of Lost Children, and that sort of got him here into America, and he did Alien Resurrection, which is awful.
Well, and it's not really worthy of his talents, because that's not whimsical at all.
Yeah, and I can see why, because like he's clearly talented, but like, I'm not going to go on about Alien, but yeah, that was kind of, it was a very silly movie, there's a lot of dumb stuff in there, and it's like, he's a guy that... Like, I guess they were trying to get that quirkiness and black comedy into that movie, but it just, something just didn't work right in that.
Yeah, I agree. But I think there was a little bit of Alien fatigue by then.
Yeah, because that was the fourth one, and the third one wasn't very good either.
Now, for all of the filmmakers out there who are getting a late start, he was 38 years old when he directed his first feature film, so there's still time.
You got time.
I have a list of things, of projects he turned down for one reason or another that I wanted to tell you about and see what you think. One of them is Life of Pi. Now, you know how I feel
about...
Going
back to cannibalism.
Yes, that's right. That's one of my all-time favorite movies. The way that it was done by Ang Lee is, I don't think anybody could possibly improve upon that. But what do you think? Because it does have some opportunity for visual sumptuousness.
Yeah, but Ang Lee has always been more of the guy with trying to do stuff like with technology. Like we talked about the last movie he did, that Billy Lynn movie. Mm-hmm. He was shooting on like this very rare type of camera that can only work in like a certain number of movie theaters. Even in like Life of Pi, he was doing with all this amazing 3D work. Mm-hmm. And even think of like the Hulk, where he was like trying to make all these transitions look like comic books. He's a guy that's always trying to do something. Even think of like all the wire work on Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and so on and so forth. He's a guy that's always trying to do stuff big with technology. I'm not really sure if Jeunet's like that. He's more of like production design.
Yeah, although some of the things that they did in... The City of Lost Children was so innovative that they needed to create new software for the special effects. So he's really out there on the bleeding edge. All right, he declined the offer to direct Hellboy before Guillermo del Toro was involved. How do you think he would have done with Hellboy?
I do like Hellboy. And, you know, him and Del Toro are pretty similar. I mean, because I actually know it wasn't Ron Perlman in City of Lost Children.
Yep.
So they kind of have that same crew. I don't know. I do like Del Toro, but I think with Jeanette, it might have been a bit more quirky and funny, but I don't know. Like, it probably would have been the same, I would say.
Also, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. And he turned that down because he said most of the creative decisions for the project had already been taken and he wouldn't have very much to add. But there's an opportunity.
That would have been. And that's one
he could have done. He could have done something cool with Harry Potter.
Yeah, I was wondering Harry Potter because I do like that movie. And I've liked all the Harry Potter movies, but one of my complaints is that the Harry Potter movies, after a while, they don't, like you said, like they have had, after like starting from Order of the Phoenix all the way through until the movies are doing now, it's always been the same director. I liked it previously when they were having different people. Like, think Chris Columbus in the first one to give it that childlike feel, and then Alfonso Cuarón in Prisoner of Azkaban to give it a more, you know, mature theme. And that's probably his version is the best of the Harry Potter films. And I forget the guy that got to do the fourth one. I think it's Mike Newell. So they had different directors, and I would have liked to have somebody else, like what they do with Mission Impossible movies, different director for every movie. And I don't like the fact that six movies, the same director. And I would have I think he could have done something good with that.
Me too, because he's good at creating sort of a fanciful place. And there's nothing but fanciful places in there.
Yeah.
Now, he does say, and I love this quote, "Cinema since the New Wave always seems to be about a couple fighting in the kitchen."
French New Wave?
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And talking about Jeanette, so he did this, then he did City Lost Children, which is huge, and he had a stinker with Resurrection, but then he had probably what everyone best knows him for, Amelie. And then what he did, a very long engagement, which kind of went back to what we talked about last time with See You Up There, which is kind of a similar story. And then there was a film in 2009, it was like Mishmash, or what was it called?
Oh, Micmac.
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 And then he did a film in America. It was called T.S. Spivet, something, something T.S. Spivet in 2013.
Oh, I don't think anybody saw that movie. Oh,
did you see it?
No.
Okay. So, like, and since then, he hasn't done anything in 5 years. And I looked at it, there's nothing rumored. So I wonder what happened to the guy.
Well, maybe he's plotting his next big movie. Let's hope. Mm-hmm. Because he's got a definite style.
Yeah, and since, I mean, any movie he's going to make, they're going to say, from the director of Amelie. Exactly. So he's always going to have people who are going to see his movies goes, oh, Amelie, I remember that film. That was big.
Right, and it was unusual, and you knew it was going to have something worth looking at. You knew the set was going to be really, really cool. He also has made a lot of money and gotten a lot of awards. The movie that we're talking about won Best Editing, Best Debut, Best Production Design, and Best Writing for Delicatessen, which is not bad for your first feature film.
At the Caesar Awards?
Yeah, the Caesar Awards. Oh, you know, another movie it reminds me of a little bit is Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, definitely. Can definitely see that. Once again, going back to that Tim Burton connection.
Yes, yes. And the, you know, using the dark for comedy. And the, and I cannot think of the actor's name, but I know you know who I mean. There's this one guy who, and he plays in Enchanted, too, and he plays the evil character. He's very fairy tale evil. And he's in Sweeney Todd as that character, and it's so perfect. But he's very much a character that, or an actor that Jeunet would like because he's got that rubbery face.
Okay, so getting close to the end of my questions here, is there anything else about Delicatessen that we haven't talked about?
I just wanted to mention that when I went in looking, you know, because I immediately thought about Soylent Green, and I thought about Sweeney Todd, and I thought about The Green Butchers, and I thought, wow, that's a lot to come up with, like, just off the fly. So I went looking up the topic, and there's a lot of movies with this topic. A couple of horror movies, I'm surprised you didn't mention. One of them, there's one movie called Hunger that they said you definitely need to look at because it will really make you take a look at your own life and the way you eat meat. And
Michael Fassbender movie?
No, but but that's I think Michael Fassbender's the best. It's been that one and Shame kind of go together.
Yeah.
But Shame, I think, is a better movie.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing director Jean-Pierre Jeunet and his 1991 film Delicatessen. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. Be sure to listen online to hear the shows a week before they're on Podbean. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying this is a job for the Australian.